because I've screwed up at least one of them. Percent of the time.
So Ron will walk you through your paperwork here.
Cool.
We're good.
We're good. We're on.
So we're on the record. History will know what I said.
Yes.
Okay.
History wants to know your viewpoint.
Yep.
So it is August 30th, 10 o'clock in the morning at the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission. We're here with
Alexis Sevendinger from the FDIC,
Ron Borzakowski from the FCSC, and Donald Barrett. If we could begin by just having you give us a quick, you know, rough professional sketch over the last few years. What positions you had, what roles you...
Oh, okay. Sure. So I'll do it reverse chronologically. That's why I have it stored in my brain. So I currently teach Georgetown in the Georgetown Public Policy Institute. I'll start classes on Wednesday. In addition, I direct something called the Urban Brookings Tax Policy Center, which is a joint venture between Urban and Brookings to study tax policy. Last year, I taught at Georgetown as well and did some private consulting. And then before that, I worked in a series of jobs in government, again, kind of reverse order. Was a member of the Council of Economic Advisors until, you know, roughly January 20th, 2009. It took me a while to get confirmed, so technically I was various things, a consultant, an advisor, all sorts of gobbledygook. But basically at the CEA from August of 2007 until January 2009. Before that, I was at the Congressional Budget Office, where I was deputy director from October of 2005 until I went over to CBA, including a year as acting director in 2006. Before that, a stint at CBA as chief economist, and before that, I was at Congress's Joint Economic Committee.
So you have a very nice seat for a lot of this.
Oh, yeah.
And it's a correlation one that the economy was in turmoil and you were at the CEA.
Yes. Yes. I went over on the Friday I was supposed to start, and I forget what the dates were, but it was like August 7th or whatever, and ended up having to work the weekend because, even though I wasn't officially there yet because the world was falling apart, little did we know how much it would fall apart even more later. But
that's true. That's the weekend of the first LIBOR-OIS spike and the collapse of the funding markets. So from that vantage point, how does the crisis look? How does it evolve from the day you show up there in August, you know, over the next 18 months? What's the...
Could you give me a little more structure on that?
Okay. So what kind of information are you seeing? Does this seem like, you know... So I'm trying to think. Let me give you one viewpoint of this. Some people describe the crisis as a long, slow train wreck.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so from the outside, the crisis of 07 sort of abates for a little while, things get better, funding pressures, the end of 07, the bear collapse, but all of it seems to sort of evolve into that slow motion arc, only getting worse and worse and worse. Is that your impression of CEA, or is it some other...
Right, well, so I mean, there are spikes, and then periods where you think things have healed somewhat, and then another spike, right? Just as you described, right? And they're sort of, you know, they're predominantly matched by Fed actions, right? So the world begins to fall apart in August of 2007, right? Fed starts doing things, eventually people start, I forget, you know, I don't have the timeline stored in my brain, but qualitatively, right, things calm down at some point. You know, you get to Bear Stearns, right, that happens again, and then you see a whole bunch of new acronyms created, and then you need to get to Lehman, and, you know, right, things get much, much worse. You know, my joking way of referring to this time period from the inside, which I think is true, is there was an awful lot of just learning about, you know, all these financial acronyms that frankly very few people knew existed, including, as I learned over time, as probably you guys have learned, you know, many of the senior managements of these companies didn't know exist. So, you know, while I have not really been a finance guy in my career, I periodically, you know, I'm relatively financially sophisticated by the standard of normal human beings, and there are an awful lot of acronyms and financial structures that I learned about that I had no clue about when I went over there. And I think that was true for a very broad category of people.
Was that a large role for the CA? Was it sort of to build that expertise as quickly as possible? I mean, I agree this is sort of a side of the world that...
Yes, exactly. So a key role for CEA was to try to explain to the folks in the administration, try to figure out what's happening, and then try to explain it in ways that, you know, non-technical people could understand. And, you know, there was definitely a period there during which it was just constant learning of, you know, what's an SIV, what's a this, what's a that.
Back in the period of time when you were chief economist with the CEA, that was 2004, 2005 period?
Yes.
Right? So Greg brought you in. Right. Nancy brought you in. Mm-hmm. And we look back now at that period as being a very important period of the development of some of the problems mm-hmm. that we now understand are there. So I know that there was a period of time in which, even reflected in the economic report of the president, there was a great touting of administration policy on housing. Talk about your role in that period of time mm-hmm. when you were working with Mankiw as economist, of the framework of thinking about encouraging minority housing and developing
terms. Right, so my stint as chief economist over there, so Greg brought me over, then he departed, then Harvey replaced him, then Harvey departed, and there were two horrible days where there were no CEA members, and then Ben arrived. So it was across kind of three chairmen plus 2 days where I don't know who the chairman was. I don't remember playing much role on the actual policy side or thinking about what our policies were, but I do distinctly remember lots of touting of increased home ownership as a metric of success in the economy. Again, I forget what the numbers were, but you know, it was a time where one of the standard talking points for the politicos was, you know, home ownership has increased yet again. I remember once we were into the Ben time period, questions started to arise, and they may have arisen sooner. I don't want to say they didn't. I just remember it from the then period. The questions started to arise or existed about to what extent can increases in house prices be explained by fundamentals versus, you know, some bubble-like activity.
Right.
And I certainly remember there being fundamentals-based arguments floating around.
So what period of time would that have been? That would have been early 2005?
I have to look at the calendar. Mm-hmm. It's sort of, you know, my overlap with Ben was relatively short, so I guess it would be later in 2005.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And then you went to CBO in October.
Right.
Okay. Well, I'm looking at the economic report of the president, which was mm-hmm. submitted in December of 2005, and that's mm-hmm. a Ben period. Ben's name's on it.
Yep.
So you would have been helping them draft this, but left for CBO.
Right.
And I'm just curious because I'm reading through it. Mm-hmm. We all know what the economic report of the president is intended to do, but there's a very long, long discursive section on the U.S. financial services sector. Do you mm-hmm. remember this part? Did you have something to do with it?
You can show it to me. I might ring a bell.
It's a long discussion, and what struck me about reading mm-hmm. it, just in passing, was the extent of which there must have been some discussion about what was happening in the financial services sector, what were the indications, what were the benefits, and all of the indications, all of the things that we've looked back on now as being challenges, you know, regulation, the growth in the financial services sector, what was happening in the housing market, everything is in here except that the assessment of the importance of it is it's a very rosy investment. So can you talk about the discussions that you remember at all about this? And I'm happy to show you this.
Oh, I can show them, yeah.
I'm just curious to what
I'm trying to remember. So there was like
such a long section, and there must have been a lot of discussion about developing it.
Let me see. 2005. Right, so I did not overlap with Kate Baker or Matt Slaughter. So as I said, right, we went down to no members, so then Ben arrived, and then they came over after me. Yeah, so I think a lot of this was actually post me. But usually the cycle of the CEA chapters is you kind of come off in September, right, you recruit the new group of senior economists, kind of in the you like to get them earlier, but inevitably you get some of them kind of August and September, and then kick off. So I'm not sure I had anything to do with this.
Do you remember what you contributed to the report for that particular report?
Well, so the chief economist's primary role was the macro stuff. I don't know if you ever encountered Steve Braun, but Steve Braun is kind of the macro economist over there, and the chief economist worked with him on sort of the feeding the macro data to the White House, mm-hmm. And then on his what's usually chapter one of the report. I know in the 2004, right, there. Whatever the years are, right? The predecessor report of this, there was also, you know, certain chapters that I played a role in kind of doing heavy editing on.
Mm-hmm. So forget the report, let's talk about just the discussion. Do you remember what kind of discussion there was about all these indicators of what was really going on? Can you remember people saying, gee, it's...
So there was the housing stuff, yeah. And it isn't about all that set of issues. There was, and I think there's a famous chapter in this report about it, there was this issue about the flow of international capital. And, you know, whether you view that as a good thing or as a bad thing, right? There was all the rhetoric about, right, so, you know, current account deficit is capital account surplus. You know, it doesn't mean that the rest of the world wants to invest here, but a whole set of issues around that. Trying to think what else. I spent an enormous amount of my time in 2005 on Social Security. I don't know what else happened. I don't remember much in, for me personally, in the finance space.
So the whole time you were with the administration, you were probably not contributing at all to discussion about this? Nothing? Zero?
No, I touched zillions of things.
Okay. So reflect back on that time. What did you see happening?
Let's see. What did we do in 04 and 05? So, I mean, there was a lot of macro housing economy doing, most of that backward looking to, you know, how many jobs have been created, kind of that whole set of issues. Like I said, so there was an enormous amount of time spent on Social Security, which was what, the election was in 04, so that would have been the bulk of 05. I think that was a period there was a bunch on pensions as well. Usually I dabble in energy policy, but I'm trying to remember, I think we were working on CAFE standards then. So it comes to mind, which is not to say there wasn't more. I mean, kind of one of the reasons I've chosen these jobs, and there are lots of fun, is you get to dabble in all sorts of things. Mm-hmm. But.
Mm-hmm. So who was the housing expert, the financial sector's expert for CEA then?
Half of the list. So there's Wendy, obviously, at the end. There was John Stevens before her.
I know them both well.
Yeah. There was Karen Dinan. She was right before me. Mm-hmm. And she was the senior macroeconomist before I got there as chief economist. And then who? Had a guy named John Driscoll. I don't know if you guys have had him through. Who was the senior macro guy. I don't think we asked him to do much on housing. Mm-hmm.
Okay. So looking back to this period, do you have any assessment about whether the administration misread the signs or, just like everyone else, didn't know what was really happening in the financial sector? I mean, just looking back.
Oh, sure. So, well, so every, you know, not everyone, but, you know, a vast swath of people, you know, across these fields, including in the administration, were overly optimistic about the housing sector. I don't really remember a lot on the finance front then. It was mostly, you know, I'm actually of the view that what we had was a credit bubble and not just a housing bubble. So I don't want to overemphasize the housing. Just the housing is the piece I remember coming up at that time.
So, elaborate on what you just said.
Let's pick up that thread.
Yeah.
All right, so my sense with the benefit of hindsight, right, you know, 2020, is that what the U.S. experienced was the credit became available for lots and lots of things, and while housing is the thing that gets most of the headlines, you know, I've never been one of the people who refers to this as a subprime crisis, right, I view it as a financial crisis or whatever. And you see, like, you see similar kinds of excesses in commercial real estate, you see similar kinds of excesses in LBOs, you know, I mean, all sorts of, you know, I mean, anecdotal metrics of that would be, you know, folks doing LBOs where they do pick bonds that, you know, toggle on, just, you know, all sorts of weird stuff that tells you, wow, credit is really, really easily available. And for me, that's consistent with the view that these, you know, this is reflective of very broad macroeconomic trends in credit markets. Most severe in housing, right? That's where it showed up here in some other countries, but it was much, you know, it was a broader thing.
So going back, so let's think about this connection to the financial, the macro side of this crisis. In the early period, have you come down on one side or the other, the sort of interest rates versus global imbalances kind of debate, which may be more to blame or potentially causal
to the...
Right, so I'm a...
Inflation of the credit bubble.
Right, so I'm definitely a many factors kind of guy, so it's not all or one, whatever. So I think the global imbalances play the role. Again, this is one of these things I sort of say tongue-in-cheek, but I actually kind of mean it, but it's not as though I've articulated and worked it out. I mean, I would say the seeds of the crisis started in 1982 or 81, right, when interest rates peaked. Right, and we suddenly, I remember distinctly as whatever it was at that time, going in to get my first CD and, you know, not wanting to invest in the 2-year CD paying 16% because I was afraid interest rates were going to go up.
I lament not taking my entire family fortune.
Yes, exactly.
16%.
Right, exactly. And so we then entered in a period in which, with bubbles around, we've been in a period in which interest rates have systematically gone down, which is something that over time has been a very favorable tailwind for certain kinds of asset investments. Right? Just makes your life easy if interest rates go down all the time. You can refi your home, you can do the moral equivalent of debt in the business investment community. And it's something that I think helped feed perceptions of asset prices rising. That, you know, that basically there was this extra tailwind that couldn't go on forever. And once you start having interest rates that are down 5, 4, 3%, at some point here you've got to begin to believe that this is going to come to an end. But again, you know, A, with benefit of hindsight, and B, built in. So there's that kind of backdrop, right? Interest rates are secularly declining, right? So therefore, buying things on leverage is a relatively good idea, right? Because the asset prices go up, and you can roll over your leverage at lower rates. So then you get in more recent times, you have these global imbalances. Basically, there's a ton of money in the world flashing around. It's, you know, all the reach for yield, blah, blah, blah stuff, right? I think all of that is true. When I worked on the stuff I had much more influence to, which I guess we'll get to, is when I was at CEA, right? So when I was at CEA the second time as a member, there were things about, like, how would the administration characterize, what caused the crisis. And so one of the few places you will see if you know it was me, you will see my fingerprints. I forget the time, but there were things like a president's speech about, okay, how did we get here? And at the time, I was really kind of leaning against the view that the Fed had that much to do with it. I've become more sympathetic since then to the argument that the Fed kept rates too low too long, right? Particularly on the too long part. Although I must admit, even back in 2003-04, I was kind of skeptical of the whole deflation thing. But I would say, yeah, okay, maybe the Fed keeping interest rates low for a long time contributed. But again, you know, if you look around the world, we are not the only country this happened to. And that there are other countries that have housing bursts and bubbles and, you know, very similar stuff. And there, you know, my view is that that reflects that there's some commonality of experience, which are both kind of macro credit trends and human psychology infirmities. The other view, which John Taylor would give you, is a view that, you know, people looked at the monetary policy in the U.S. and decided to adopt it in their own countries. I find that less, you know, you could convince me that was true, but as yet I find that less compelling.
So we enter 2005, 6, up until, let's say, summer of 2007, it's growing incredible. As you pointed out, residential real estate, commercial real estate, some corporate lending. The LBOs and syndicated loans, collateralized loan obligations. And how does that morph into a financial crisis? How do you see the connection from that to, let's say, the next 18 months and the period, you know, that you witnessed from the CEO?
Right, so leveraged guys loan these things who, you know, leverage works well on the way up and it works terribly on the way down. I mean, it's basically the short answer. Right, the way I frame it is if you think about, okay, what was the infirmity in Donald thinking in, late 2007, right, where you realize bad things are happening, you realize there are going to be significant asset losses on housing-related stuff. Why then was I not screaming, hey, you know, the world's coming to an end? And for me, I tell you, for my problem was that I learned the wrong lesson from what we had from the tech bubble and burst back at the turn of the century, which is a fun expression to use. I lived through that, you know, I went off to be CFO of a tech startup, and I kind of, you know, have the wounds from being in that bubble too late.
Days.
Yes, my Austin days. And so which was so terrible. I worked so hard, I didn't even go visit the bats. So I had to go back to Austin this year just to see the famous bats that live under the bridge. And the lesson back then was, and I hate to be flippant about numbers and trillions of dollars, but this is what this line of activity does for you. So back then in the tech boom and bubble, people experienced losses of several trillion dollars. I forget the exact number, but you know, several trillion. Sitting in late 2007, kind of, you know, the big numbers people were, and I may have the calendar slightly off, but the basic idea is the big numbers that people were talking about were a trillion or 2 trillion or 3 trillion. And so the inference I drew from that wrongly was, okay, right, this is bad, and let's look at the last time we had a bubble burst and have losses of several trillion dollars. And the answer, frankly, was back in, you know, 2001, we had an unfortunate recession with a lot of job loss, but by the standards of recessions, nothing to write home about. And so it seemed as though, and you remember, you know, other economic folks said things like this, that, you know, hey, you know, I think the word of the day was contained, right? That, you know, we've got, yes, people are going to lose some money, yeah, trillion, 2 trillion, whatever. That's unfortunate, but not, you know, the end of the world. Now, to our credit, you know, it was, I mean, I don't even remember the exact calendar, but say, certainly in November, no later than December, we at CEA of 2007, we at CEA were running around designing a stimulus package. Like, because we perceived that the macroeconomy was going to be weak, and that if, you know, kind of consistent with the notion of doing stimulus, it would make sense to do something. And that that's what gave rise to the 2008 stimulus that came along. So there was definitely concern about the state of the economy, but it was concern in kind of traditional moderate or light recession concern, not off-the-cliff concern.
Was the thinking back then primarily, I mean, there are two hits to the real economy at that point. I mean, one is the loss in housing wealth. Earlier in 2006, house prices had peaked. You're beginning to see increasing foreclosures from some of the subprime lending. Mm-hmm. But the other large trend is just the constriction of the housing sector itself. It had grown quite large and was... Do you remember which of those two, or if it's, you know, were most of
the mind is driving? No, I mean, if both of those, I'm sure we had both of those in mind at the time, but.
Okay. But you do see sort of the economy slowing from these particular headwinds.
Oh, absolutely.
And then, so what else was missed? You know, I like infirmity of thinking. Oh, that's great, because I think lots of people suffered the infirmity. What else was missed from, you know, a couple trillion dollars in losses, which it could be a lot like 2001, soft landing kind of stories, to, you know, the conflagration that became 2008?
Right, so the main gap is kind of leverage and systemic financial risk, and that's the right way to say it. Right, so the leverage means that you have a big financial hole to fill, right, when asset values start going down. And then there's basically a tempo question of how fast financial firms can fill in that gap and thereby be able to maintain the, you know, a reasonable level of credit provision in the economy. And their ability to keep up, and this is why people were using the word contained, and then why eventually it fell out of favor and is now mocked. Is right. The notion was that, yes, there were going to be these losses, but there's enough time for, and again, I don't have the exact calendar in my mind, so these are impressionistic, but there was, you know, a hope that, you know, firms could go hat in hand to private investors, the sovereign wealth funds of the world, fill in their holes, recognize that, yes, they were too ambitious on some of their housing investments and move on. And the challenge, of course, was that that was partly true, right? That a bunch of firms did, in fact, go hat in hand to various kinds of investors, raise some degree of capital, which gave some evidence that that view of the world is right. It's just, it, you know, nowhere near kept up.
And the losses that were then suffered, you know, basically digging this capital hole deeper and deeper, do you view those, in your mind, are those real estate related, residential real estate related, or from a sort of broader range of assets, you know, sold off in the sort of a deleveraging cycle? Because one view of the world is really what came to happen was all of that $1 trillion of potential subprime losses hit the system and, you know, there wasn't $1 trillion of capital to make it up. And, mm-hmm. The other is in the rapid deleveraging, you start losing money on all kinds of assets because you have to sell. Mm-hmm. Did you guys have data on that? Were you tracking any of that in your personal opinion?
Yes, I mean, I know we thought about that at the time. I haven't thought as much about that. I mean, there was this... There was this whole thing which happened with the quant funds that just comes to mind for me, where they kind of like for, you know, 5 days, they were the big thing, right? That, you know, all the correlations were going in the reverse directions and they were all having incredible difficulties, and then that fell off. So I remember that. I mean, that went away so fast we didn't have much on it. So I remember thinking about this. I'm not sure if I have anything intelligent to say about it. But we all sort of, you know, the fire sale stuff, right? I mean, that was part of what led eventually to, you know, TARP 1.0, if you want to call it that. Let's say, you know, step in, make a market, create real prices, you know, again, with a housing orientation, but the idea of basically, you know, helping broken markets find more realistic prices.
Going in the last half of the way, did the CEA get involved in some of those debates? I mean, there's a lot of discussion throughout Washington. I was wondering the CEA's role in how would you structure a troubled asset relief program, you know, buying up assets.
Oh, yeah.
And like, okay. Was that something you were working on, or just particularly?
Yeah. I mean, sort of, you know, the division of labor, well, you know, so go back to the Gideon. So Hank negotiated a good deal with the president. Right, so Hank had more access and power than the average cabinet secretary, which was, you know, part of the deal. I mean, I wasn't privy to this, so I just secondhand my senses, right? So he had a better deal than the average cabinet secretary. And so he obviously, once his theory of things were going terribly, right, you will have noticed that a lot of the center of gravity policy activity moved from the White House to Treasury. I didn't mean the White House was sitting around twiddling its thumbs, right? I mean, this is, you know, A, part of our role was to kind of inform the White House of our view of what the heck is going on, and then also to help brainstorm about solutions, and then, you know, comment on whatever Treasury was coming up with.
Do you think that was appropriate?
Yeah.
Necessary?
I think it was a good delegation of authority. Yeah, I mean, you know, obviously the White House people always felt like, hey, it would be great if we had, you know, there wasn't as much of a policy process as there is for other things that happen, you know, before in the economic space or in other lines of work. But, you know, if I'd been the president, I probably would have made the same choice.
Are you suggesting that it, because of the relationship between the two men, that the power gravitated to Treasury because of that?
Well, then kind of Hank came in with that, you know, hey, I don't want to, I mean, again, this is all like second or third hand from, you know, reading the same things you guys have read, but that, you know, his deal was, I'm not sure if I want to do this, you know, cabinet secretaries go to Washington, their reputations go down, and why on earth would I want to do this, and that the offer in return was, we'll give you a lot of autonomy.
So during this period where the influence shifts to Treasury, mm-hmm. to what extent were the smart thinking, whatever it was that existed in the White House, still filtering into that discussion? What was the process?
So, I mean, the parts of the process I saw were, you know, so I talked a lot with Phil Swagel and Neil about various things. You know, Eddie talked a lot to Hank. There was, you know, a process that was somewhat opaque to me in which Joel Kaplan seemed to sort of, it wasn't detailed with Treasury, that's not the right idea, but he seemed to spend an awful lot of his time over at Treasury talking to folks. And there were, you know, so there were channels of communication, but they weren't kind of, you know, what the traditional ones were.
But it wasn't as if there were still lots of economic sessions in the Roosevelt world.
Right. But you lost, right, the traditional policy process, as you know, is kind of, you know, you'd have a deputies meeting, you'd have a principals meeting, you'd have policy time with the president.
And it was gone.
It happened occasionally. But that there was a certain amount of reading about policies in the newspaper on Monday morning, which in this electronic age actually means reading about them on Sunday night online,
right.
But metaphorically on Monday morning, and going, oh, that's what we did, you know, under some circumstances. But not at all. Like, you know, I mean, the Fannie and Freddie thing, I was not at the meeting. I only have Eddie Lazier's characterization of what happened at the meeting. But on the Fannie and Freddie thing, I'm told there was a meeting in which, you know, they went around the table and they said, you know, what do folks think? And, you know, when Eddie Lazier, who was perceived as being maybe not the most right-wing economist, economic person in the administration, but certainly representative of the right wing, when he said, yeah, of course we ought to put him in conservatorship, you know, that kind of sealed the deal. So there was at least some process by which that decision, before it happened, you know, went through a principles, you know, or a policy time. Mm-hmm. So there was not a complete loss of the usual policy process, but there's definitely much less of it.
To what extent did the president and the Treasury Secretary turn to Lazier? I remember him mostly because he did a lot of biking with the president.
Right. So he had a lot of informal communication with the president, which again, so I was never present for any of that, so but it seemed fruitful. Mm-hmm. And Eddie and Hank talked all the time. And
mm-hmm. So if there was thinking or an idea or a concept that was developing inside the White House, that there was a, you're saying there was a conduit, there were several...
Well, there was a conduit, but the, you know, the pace of decision-making was such that sometimes, you know, that didn't happen. I mean, but again, so I'm down a level, right? So I know less than Eddie, but, you know, about the moment by moment. Mm-hmm. So from where I said, for example, the decisions to insure the money market funds, right? I only knew that, you know, an hour after it happened, or whatever, not before. Now, there may have been some discussion at a higher level that Eddie was privy to that was, you know, T-minus rather than T-plus, but at least down at my level, it was, you know, after the fact.
Looking back, if there had been more deliberation or a more iterative process to think through, do you think any of the decisions or the policies might have been improved? And which ones?
Yeah, well, so the big debate... One of the big debates is what you do with TARP. Mm-hmm. And we, the economists, we were all, and again, I don't want to oversell the timing of it, but before the 2.5-page version of TARP went up to the Hill, we, Eddie, mm-hmm. we were all the, we need to inject equity, mm-hmm. right, folks. And that was not where Hank was. Hank was at, we need to buy up toxic assets. And I'm sure you guys have done me, right? Mm-hmm. You can just sit down and do the little balance sheet of a firm and say, where does the dollar go further? And where are all the geeks going? It goes further over here. Mm-hmm. And he wasn't there yet. And, you know, I don't know when he got there, but it was certainly after the text went up there and after the ball got rolling, the TARP was going to be used to buy up toxic assets. And
do you remember, backing up here, why was this so important to him compared to the other arguments here?
Well,
why was this important to him?
So I can't speak to why it was important to him. Mm-hmm. I want to make that clear. Mm-hmm. I can speak to why I think it was important to some people. Mm-hmm. And there were at least two categories that I remember. There was first the whole, I'm going to use the word socialism in its now 2010 notion, of it's bad to buy equity and control, and therefore we ought to just buy assets. That was for a school of thought. And I think, and again, I can't speak to any individuals, but I think there was a perception among some folks that you could not get congressional Republicans to vote for buying stock and companies, and that therefore the politically constrained optimal was to go buy assets. Mm-hmm. And from my point of view, at the time, I was like, okay, this is a classic thing that comes up when you're doing economic policy, right? You tell me the political constraints, then I will tell you if what you're doing is constrained reasonable policy response. And the answer to that is yes, right? If you tell me the political constraints are you can't do the equity thing that I think is best, fine. Buying assets is better than nothing. So, which is kind of where we were, you know, around TARP 1.0. The other view, and this is again, this is one of these memes that popped up and then went away, but I think was actually quite influential, and you guys will remember what week it is there started being serious, like super serious people who were arguing that what we need is an RTC. And I forget whose op-ed it was, you know, it was Bill Seidman or Volcker or some such, again, not sure who it was, but human beings of that stature who were saying you need an RTC. And we, the geeks, were all sitting around going, okay, how do you do an RTC, right? The beauty of the old RTC model is you have a whole bunch of, and beauty, that's in quotes, people on the table. Mm-hmm. The beauty of that model back as it was originated was you have a whole bunch of banks that fail, that go to the FDIC, and you are endowed with a whole bunch of assets that you, the RTC, can then manage. In the state we were in, yes, there were some banks going through the FDIC, but really the question was how do you acquire the assets? And so an argument for a TARP-like activity was that if you think the RTC is the solution, but you haven't taken over the banks yet, you either have A, take over the banks, which was not on the table at that time, or B, you've got to go acquire the assets. And so I think there was a group of people who were kind of in the RTC mindset, and that led them to a toxic asset buying approach to this challenge.
I want to go back to something you were just saying. You were talking about the political constraints, mm-hmm. and that perhaps there were a group of individuals inside the administration who had that very prominently in their mind, Paulson perhaps being one. To what extent do you believe, looking back at that period, that the political dynamics played a role in a way that was perhaps more important than the economic discussions or the fundamental discussion, or how much do you think it shaped?
I think the political limitations shaped a lot, which of course was driven home by the first vote on TARP, right, which failed, and the stock market plummeted, and all that pain of that week. Mm-hmm. It was not obvious that you could get Congress to do what the geeks thought was the best solution, mm-hmm. and so there was a perfectly legitimate, sincere question about how do you how do you find out what's doable. Mm-hmm. This was a period in which the coalition was, the president, I don't know directly, but conceptually it was kind of, the administration and the president and, the Speaker of the House and the leader of the Senate trying to triangulate what would be a doable thing. Mm-hmm.
To what do you attribute that first vote?
Mm-hmm. Right. So there are a lot of people, the economists and the geeks are beginning to see the world ascending in some sense, mm-hmm. or at least some. And at the same time, you have a policy response that is halting at best.
Right.
Do you have a sense of why that particular disconnect, or if there was a disconnect?
Well, so we've been doing rhetoric on this point for a while, but it's still nonetheless true that I think for many average citizens, the connection between banks, which sounds like Wall Street, which sounds like, God knows who, whoever the moral equivalent of Ivan Boesky was at the moment, the connection between that and helping them and $700 billion was hard to connect. Right? There's kind of how it gets reflected in the votes is primarily got reflected in right-wing populist votes, but the same concern existed on the left-wing populist side that, connecting the dots from what was being proposed to benefiting, a person on the street was very hard. Now, again, there was a lot of communication that was associated. You'll see in the speeches of the time the phrase Main Street starts appearing left, right, and center, trying to communicate that was perceived that these policies were intended to help Main Street. But I think that's something that's hard for a lot of normal human beings to appreciate. And you see that even now, right? I mean, you've got all these people who think TARP was a failure. I'm like, TARP has warts, and TARP isn't perfect, but geez, by the standards of, from my humble view, right, from the standards of large-scale public policies to address problems, it's hard to put TARP in the failure category.
So if the Commission wants to take on that role, I can't speak for the Commission, but if they want to take on the role of explaining to the American people, to the audience of the final report, the connection between Wall Street and Main Street. Mm-hmm. How should we do that? Or how would you do that?
Well, it's interesting. So I would, if I had infinite time and resources.
We have neither.
I understand. So there's an interesting question about how much of financial activity in the U.S. is productive and helpful, and how much of it seems excessive. And I have some intuition that we have both, right? We have incredibly productive, useful, right, allocate savings to investors, all the good story of finance in this country, and then we also have some excesses. And then you'd want, in a perfect world, you'd try to characterize where that line is. Then staying on the side that's good, I would say that, a lot of economic activity depends on the flow of credit, right? And, the way you dress that up for Main Street is you talk about the local dry cleaner, and the local dry cleaner's got to, borrow money from a bank in order to invest in a new, whatever dry cleaners use, piece of equipment to, run their business, and the guy who opens a restaurant needs to, buy a stove and get a lease and all that kind of stuff, and then all of that requires a well-functioning financial architecture. And that it's not just Jimmy Stewart's small banks that are in a well-functioning system. You know, all this scary-sounding stuff that Wall Street does about securitization and whatnot has the beneficial effect of making interest rates cheaper, making credit more available, and that that part of these activities is beneficial for everybody. And that most jobs in the economy have some degree of capital investment associated with them. You know, if you're a school bus driver, it's a school bus, if you know, whatever. And that finance helped that be possible.
So,
and then there's the other, side of the line, which is much more of a kind of rent-seeking set of activities that look less favorable.
Within many doctoral theses, I think, will be written, hopefully, kind of find that line or figured out. Post TARP, as we go to the end of 2008, you see this incredibly rapid constriction of the U.S. economy, Q4 and Q1 of 2009. Do you have a sense to how much of that is a typical credit crunch? Is the result of this, in econ speak, the lack of credit intermediation following a crisis, and how much is driven more by real side effects, the ones we spoke about earlier, the continued housing, the continued destruction of wealth, the destruction of stock wealth that happened in that fall?
I'm not even trying to tease those out, right, because they intermesh. The last time I looked at the Reinhardt-Rogoff stuff, they seemed to suggest that we were pretty garden variety for a terrible financial crisis, if that's responsive. So that, we're kind of at that point we were kind of following the path of if you have a big financial shock, this is approximately what happens to your economy.
Without just entangling whether it's simply a credit crunch and the lack of availability of credit or whether...
Right, exactly. Right there is this kind of reduced form. Here it all is, all in one package. We're following that. Yeah, you can do the housing one. I haven't done it, or I don't remember doing it. Right, you can do the housing one arithmetically out of the GDP data. You can estimate the wealth effect one out of consumption data. That's doable, but yeah.
Do you have a sense for the role of just pure fear or panic in these things?
So that's another great doctoral dissertation. Anyone who gets this tape, because the comparison I have in mind, this is probably beyond the scope of what you guys want to get into, is I remember, I think it was in October of 2008, that we're all flipping out here in the United States, and there's all the rhetoric about Hank Paulson down on his knees to Nancy Pelosi and blah, blah, blah. And I forget the exact timing, but, there's this one morning where all of a sudden there's this PDF from Britain that is, here's our 15-page plan, right, with none of the... great public spectacle of requiring the head of the Fed and the Treasury Secretary to go to Congress and say, the world may come to an end on Thursday. And I've always wondered whether you can use some of that information to get at this question about fears. My sense is that in the United States, basically to get the House of Representatives to go along, we had to ratchet up the fear. And even then, we didn't succeed until they voted against TARP and the stock market plummeted, and then we had enough fear. Whereas in a parliamentary system, right, Britain just goes, works it out, around the table like this, and then issues their plan. And so, my sense is there was much less public fear from public officials in the Britain approach than in the U.S. approach. My sense, frankly, is that I'm not sure that had that big a macro effect. I know some people, I'm open to the suggestion that we kind of killed animal spirits here in the U.S. with all fear mongering, but I haven't actually seen anyone connect the dots in a compelling way on that.
Let me ask you a very simple man on the street sort of question. In the United States, was it necessary to get to that point where you scare the living what out of people? Because up until that point of time, every authority that the American people could possibly point to had been telling them it was great. Mm-hmm. Everything was great. So didn't we need that?
We wouldn't have under our parliamentary system just...
No, but I'm just saying, the trust level had been that the Federal Reserve... members of Congress, the financial leaders, world leaders had all been saying that nothing bad was happening to the economy.
Mm-hmm.
So, wasn't that, you're sort of making light of the fact that they had to shove Congress to be scared, very, very afraid. But isn't there some culpability on the part of all these authority figures who for years have been saying everything was great?
Oh, I think there's culpability that goes back, across many, many generations here, at least many decades, right, that we had... So we had a, let's call it a regulated banking system. I won't characterize the regulation, but we had a regulated banking system that, you know, does its thing. And then we had this growth of the shadow banking system, which was largely under the radar screen from kind of most normal human beings' point of view, frankly from a lot of regulators' point of view, and then kind of understandably as a result from the politicians' view above that. And that as a result, we went, you know, we went from a world in which we thought, this before I was live, you know, we thought we had a regulatory structure in place for the, you know, the key arteries of the financial system, to one in which we didn't, and that, you know, no one picked up on that along the way.
No.
And that, you know, no one in, you know, no one who is taking steps and doing stuff. I mean, I suppose you can always find some people, right? The question is, you know, I mean, take me for example, right? What was the first thing I did, not first, one of the first things I did when I got to CBO as acting director, right? So I'd become acting director. One of the first things I do is I put Norio Rubini on our economic advisory board, right? Because I know there are guys out there who have like a compelling, you know, savvy, the world is coming to an end story, right? So very useful to have him on the board. Does he convince the other people on my board? No. Right, so, you know, yes, he had a lot of it right, but it wasn't, for whatever reason, you know, was not something that kind of spread and convinced folks.
And he didn't persuade you?
I don't know. I mean, you know, I marked down CBO's economic forecast that year unilaterally. So, you know, not down to these levels, but I certainly took it down from where it had been. So, you know, a whole bunch of things, basically, you know, it's a hard way to describe it, right? A whole bunch of things evolved in the economy. The regulatory apparatus and the kind of political apparatus for overseeing it didn't keep up. And you ended up in this situation where we didn't have the ability to address some of the challenges that would come up. But, yeah, so, you know, I mean, resolution authority, right? So we did not have a resolution authority for these things that suddenly existed. But that's, you know, with the benefit of hindsight, right, it's kind of insane. Right. Now, you know, how you attribute blame for that, I have no idea, because we've been lacking that resolution authority for a very long time.
Mm-hmm. So, I'm sorry, I didn't run the wrong question to you about the psychology of all this.
Mm-hmm. Oh, so I don't mean to make light of it. I just, you know, there was, I have wondered whether the difference between the U.S. and the British one might someday reveal information that would shed light on this question. And I know there are people like John Taylor who are trying to parse the actual daily movement of various spreads to try to say it wasn't Lehman, it was X. And I think that is a useful line of research, but I personally haven't taken anything from that line of research that I would bring to you and say, yes, you know, it mattered a lot. And, you know, obviously, yes, the animal spirits matter.
You were talking about regulation.
Mm-hmm.
What surprised you? What did you learn about regulation? You just started to describe it.
Mm-hmm.
What did you learn?
Oh, so for me, the thing that surprised me the most, and again, being someone who kind of follows these things and kind of has a clue, so if I'm surprised, well, actually, two things come to mind. So if I'm surprised, on these two things, I take it as evidence that something's amiss. So the first thing that surprised me was that credit ratings differed across asset classes, right? And so that AAA in the municipal space means something different than in the federal government space and different from in the corporate space. Okay. I spent a lot of my time thinking about like how to communicate complicated economic issues. Okay. That struck me as insane. And it's something that was very late to the game, but really? They mean different. So I think that was a terrible failing of someone in the communications realm somewhere.
Means different things as in probably default on the PD for AAA corporate are not the same as for a structured product or the same for a gutty.
Right.
Yes. Okay.
So I still feel that's insane. Give them different names. Something. What was the other one? Oh, the other one was, I had thought, and again, you know, I knew a little bit about this, but not super expert. I had thought that one of the outgrowths of Enron was that we had solved the whole hiding something in some weird entity off balance sheet in order to, like, you know, take risks but not show them, you know, not reveal them in my financial statements. And so I personally was pretty surprised when we got into the financial crisis and we started hearing about SIBs this and blah, 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 that. And you discover that there's some off-balance things that the banks have been doing that they have not, I think from investors' point of view, been appropriately disclosing on their financial statements and integrating up, where the banks felt like in some cases they had to step in and backstop these entities with real live money from their shareholders, and yet the shareholders, if they were looking at the balance sheet, would own, you know, the what. And I had been under the impression, mistakenly obviously, that kind of the post-Enron reforms had tried to address that, and I personally had not appreciated that it hadn't really worked in the financial sector.
And who failed in that? Where did the failure occur there?
So I don't know. I don't know if it's in Sarbanes-Oxley or the implementation of it. Mm-hmm. I think I've heard rumors it's actually in Starbucks itself somewhere, but I don't. Mm-hmm. I don't know that that's true.
Okay.
So you touched on a lot of the issues I think that the commission has covered in the hearings. We've done, you know, a lot of housing securitization, the shadow banking, the growth of the shadow banking system as this less regulated to the SIFI system, as you may have seen our work on derivatives, which some people think was a cause of the crisis, hasn't come up in our conversation today. Are there particular causes of the crisis you think we have missed, or that, you know, we should, the commission should use its last remaining months to examine, that you would like to know? Are there any that, you know, you've heard bantered around in the popular press that as potential causes of the crisis that you're pretty sure are not?
Oh, I mean, you know, it's all the, you know, Community Reinvestment Act, you know, mumbo jumbo. But I think you guys already wrote a state through that, didn't you? Maybe you guys have some sort of, sorry, not you, but your researchers, I think, have some right piece on that. Gotta remember, what are the other ones out there? But so, like I said, I think I personally think if there's some truth to the argument that kind of the whole tailwind of declining interest rates for a prolonged period kind of, you know, helped fuel this, that, you know, created a perception that asset prices go up more than they, you know, necessarily would, where that wasn't true. This is not a specific thing. To the extent you have the opportunity, learning from what happened in other countries, I think, is informative. And again, you know, one of the reasons I think I put less weight on the Fed than some other people do is I look and say, wow, this happened in a whole bunch of countries. And that's, well, that doesn't mean we should hold harmless a whole bunch of Americans who are engaged in various activities. To me, that says that there is an important story that's going to be something larger. And it's either going to be either or both of a global capital markets kind of story, like, you know, savings club, or it's going to be a human infirmities thing, right? The people everywhere, you know, see house prices go up and they start getting bubble thinking. Or it might be some story about correlated regulatory approaches. But there's something that one can learn from the fact that this happened in more countries than just the United States. And while we were the biggest and, you know, the second worst maybe after Iceland, that it is, it's very, you know, any of the explanatory approaches that say it's because of some narrowly crafted U.S.-specific activity, to me, strike me as things that have to be missing a significant portion of what the challenge was.
Your suite on the Fed, but to what extent have you been critical of them?
So I said at the time, and like when I was working on, again, I forget the timing, but whenever the president was doing kind of his first speech about what the causes were, you know, I was kind of, you know, let's not blame the Fed. I've since become more sympathetic to the Fed kept rates too long, too low, too long.
But that's it.
There's the whole, you know, kind of regulatory side of the Fed that I personally never, I mean, it's not something I personally was tasked with. I never understood why the Fed was the right entity to do consumer regulation. I understand there are some synergies of information flow, et cetera, but I'm more of a, you know, like one of the reasons I like CBO as an organization, CBO has one thing, right? So go tell the truth to Congress about budget and economic matters. Like, okay, that's, you know, you can communicate that message to your team, you can be the leader of that, and, like, you know, everyone gets it. You know, from my point of view, when you're designing institutions for the Fed, right, you know, some combination of macro and financial stability is like the right kind of level of thing. And if you're asking them to do consumer protection, that strikes me as weird. And so it's not surprising to me ex post that, you know, I don't think they did a very good job at it.
Do you have the same critique of something like the SEC, for example, with sort of an historic investor protection mission and then following 2004 reforms, more of this consolidated supervision?
I think it's right.
Is that the same two-headed monster kind of problem?
Well, okay, so what does the SEC do, right? So it's supposed to protect investors, right? But that seems to be a relatively well-defined, you know, across securities markets kind of thing. It had this, whatever those words you just were.
The CFC, the Consolidated Supervised Entity Program post-2004, and they are the consolidated regulator for the investment banks under Basel. And some people have said, you know, again,
I haven't thought as much about that one. I haven't thought as much about the SEC, but that feels like something worth thinking about. I mean, of course, that particular office no longer exists.
So are there any, so his final words, is there any, on a very micro level, I mean, are there particular things you wish you knew that you think the commission should go and uncover? I mean, I agree with you putting the international comparisons as a way to think about the problem. But are there particular, you know, with our investigatory authority, things you think we should try to learn on behalf of the American people, or stories we should try to tell that haven't come out? Or any other things you sort of say, you know, if I were you guys, I would make sure you really understand this.
So I personally still do not understand what happened to AIG. And I look forward to your chapter or book on what happened to AIG.
In terms of the growth of the financial products groups and how they got themselves in that position, or the rescue of AIG?
So both, but primarily the former. I still have not been able. But again, you guys may have already made this public, and I just haven't, you know, assimilated it. I still don't understand how this one group managed to expose the company to such enormous risk without people in other higher layers of management freaking out. And I don't know whether that was a modeling problem or an organizational problem or an inability to see tail risks problem or what. But it seems, you know, I think that's probably what Alan Greenspan had in mind when he had his famous quote about, you know, one of his lessons from this experience is that large financial institutions were not as good at taking care of their own interests as he would have expected. It's just, it seems anomalous, and it would be nice to know why that happened. Now, maybe the answer's already out there, I just haven't simulated it. And then I must admit, the TikTok on exactly the federal response to AIG, I haven't fully... Yeah, because that was so far, it was up basically the New York Fed in its first incarnation. And I don't actually understand what happened there either. But again, you guys may already know.
Since you're here, can I ask you for 2 seconds to look ahead?
Sure.
How bad is it and how long is it going to be bad?
Excuse me. So I've been a long U guy. Right? So, you know, I'm not an L. We're not going to go sideways forever. But it's going to take a while to start going back up. So far, the world has cooperated with that forecast, unfortunately. Or fortunately, depending on which...
Right.
Way it would have deviated. I've probably gone overboard. One of the ongoing difficulties in American policymaking, generally economic policymaking specifically, is there's a high degree of parochialism. Both, folks tend to focus on U.S. examples and U.S. experience. And there is also a certain amount of parochialism of the present over the past, right? So that, you know, the metaphors that people invoke are the savings and loans crisis, you know, at first. And one of the things I tried to do, and I've been going down this learning curve myself, as well as, you know, more international comparisons, as I said, and more historical comparisons. So I now may have gone overboard, but at the moment I tend to just try to figure out whatever kind of the Reinhard Rogoff, you know, what does history tell us is an average kind of financial downturn, and take that as a starting point. So I don't have it loaded up in my short-term memory today as I sit here, but I would kind of start with what they've described as being kind of the typical evolution of one of these things and say, you know, how do you feel we're doing? I'd like to think we're going to do better than that because we've learned some of the lessons of history. But, you know, counter to that is, you know, their data set also includes folks like Sweden who, you know, handle their crises very well, and we're also lucky of, you know, if you could have your financial crisis at any moment in time, the early 1990s was a great time because the world economy was about to grow very rapidly. So, you know, you weigh that all together, and I say, okay, historical average is probably the right place to begin your view of the future.
And what's the thing that worries you the most, personally?
What's up? I'm a little worried about the whole Iran nuclear Israel thing. Frankly, but just it's an area that I have no expertise about it, but just it seems to be something that
it could be a bad problem.
Yes, it could be a very bad problem, way outside my area of expertise. But you know, you kind of hear periodically headlines about with Iran nuclear and Israel, and you know, thank you. So that worries me a little. So people have talked about the whole commercial real estate thing. Which has been, you know, the most forecast, predicted crisis, you know, in the history of the planet. And we're kind of going through it, but I do worry a little bit about the whole, you know, extend and pretend, roll it over, you know, push this off thing. You know, in that space and more generally. I personally do not worry about inflation breaking out. So, you know, we could have an interesting discussion about whether the Fed has the right tools to fight deflation, but the Fed, our guys at the Fed know how to fight inflation if that becomes a problem, right? So, you know, in the ongoing debate about are we going to be Zimbabwe or Japan, I would say Zimbabwe is off the table. Japan is still, unfortunately, in the running. Mm-hmm. Like, the folks in Japan did the L, and it's not as though they're idiots. And so... I do worry about that scenario.
Okay. Thank you.
Sure. Any parting thoughts? Hey, look forward to the book.
Well, thank you very, very much for your time this morning.
Hey, sir.
This has been great. Much, much appreciated.
Is there anyone you think that the team hasn't talked to that should be talked to?
So have you gone through all those staffers at the Fed? I assume you have, sort of Andreas Leonard and Karen Diamond and Wayne Passmore and kind of this whole cast of characters?
Some of them.
Okay.
What do you think that they would illuminate?
Well, so the beauty of the Fed is that they have a lot of people who are incredibly deep in particular areas, and so if you get ones who are relatively senior in the food chain, you know, and have people in them, they know these topics in great detail, they've seen a lot of what's gone on, and they also have people there who have a lot of institutional memory, mm-hmm. and so they can do some of the, hey, I remember what happened in year X kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And so at CEA, we always made a point of hiring someone, you know, like Wendy or Karen or whoever to come over and be the senior macro person, because they had this great knowledge base, and I think they're, you know, they're an incredible resource, and obviously from the Fed's perspective. But you know, who else? But depending on yourself, I don't know if you've interviewed any of the folks from Sweden who worked them through their financial crisis back in the early 90s. I mean, I've read their stuff, I haven't talked to them personally, but they're kind of interesting for a perspective on, you know, how one manages things like this. But that would be for kind of a broader set of issues.
What do you think of anybody?
Okay. And then I would love to know the answer to the credit rating thing. Like, what lunatic decided that the same letters would mean different things for different categories of assets?
It's perfectly reasonable. If everybody in the market knows that, it's right. Not a market of perfection, right? So you need a less, you know, so we've relied to some extent, going back into the weeds, on the qualified institutional buyers and the sort of idea of the sophisticated investor being appropriate for market discipline and being appropriate for functioning markets. It's the combination of, I guess, you must inherently have some view that some of them are not that sophisticated and that this thing was being blurred.
Right, information is expensive to gather.
In which case, there's some group
of people. Go back, you know, to the stock options debate, right? So I was always of the view that stock options ought to be expensed right now. You can tell the counter argument, which is you have sophisticated investors, and as long as in a footnote, they can do arithmetic. And my answer to that is, well, yeah, they could also do arithmetic, take it out, right? What do you want your top line, headline, quoted, right, efficient transmission of information thing to say? And my thank you for the credit rating. So yes, absolutely. Sophisticated investors might get it, but you know, a lot of communication takes place to simplify things, and you gotta take that into account.
Okay.
And the evidence seems to be in favor of that.
Yeah. So.
Well, once again, many thanks.
Hey, sure. Thanks.
Thanks very much for your time.